Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Case Podcast. This is Joy Clark. And today I am at the Euro Closure and I have a guest, Alex Miller, who is working on Closure at Cognitech and is also the author of Closure Applied. Thank you for taking the time to talk to me.
Oh, you're welcome.
So we're at the Euro Closure this week and it's a Closure conference. So can you tell us a little bit about what Closure is?
Sure. It's a functional dynamic language that runs on the Java virtual machine. And then there's also a version called Closure Script that targets, that transpiles to JavaScript and runs on JavaScript engines instead.
So what does it roughly look like?
So it is a Lisp dialect. And so it looks like things like Lisp or Scheme or Racket. And that means most people, their familiarity with that is it's a lot of parentheses. And that's something that is most Closure developers describe a sense of stop seeing those after a while. And you start thinking instead in the structure of your code because it sort of makes the structure of your code sort of lays that bare. Mm-hmm. And so I find that's a very natural way for me to think about it. And in Closure, everything is an expression and every expression is surrounded by parentheses. So mm-hmm. it's a very regular structure.
So do you still see the parentheses or do you kind of filter them out now?
I see them, but I'm really thinking in terms of expressions. And so okay. I think that's what people mean when they say that is that you stop sort of thinking in terms of syntax and it's really, you're thinking more in the structure of the code instead. Mm-hmm.
So how does it differ from like more mainstream programming languages?
In some sense, it's similar to other mainstream programming languages. It has all the same kinds of things that you have in other languages, like the ability to do conditionals and looping constructs and things like that. So in function invocation, all those things are things that exist in Closure as well. It's a dynamic language, so it has some similarities to other dynamic languages like Ruby or Python or even JavaScript in that sense. It's a functional language, so it has definitely an orientation around functions, and that's similar to other functional languages, things like OCaml or Haskell or Scala or something like that. So it has some similarities to a number of different languages. A couple of the identifying characteristics of Closure are definitely that from the very beginning, it's had a focus on working with immutable values mm-hmm. as data. And many people describe that as sort of the key thing that they enjoy in Closure. And that's, it underlies a lot of the other things that you have in Closure, like the concurrency constructs and state constructs and things like that. They all really rely on or based on this dealing with immutable data. Mm-hmm. So
what's the strength of Closure? What types of problems is Closure particularly good at solving?
So Closure was designed by Rich Hickey, and he had done a lot of work in C++ and C# and Java and Common Lisp and things like that. And part of the rationale for Closure was really to be good in the kinds of applications where Java is good for applications. And Java, of course, is used in a very wide variety of scenarios. And I think Closure can also be used in a very wide set of places. Not all of those are the perfect fit for Closure. So there's definitely places where like embedded code or, different, more specialized things, but sort of just generic business applications and things like that is where I think Closure provides a really, really hits a sweet spot for that kind of stuff. Yeah. And that's what people are using it for mostly.
Mostly like web applications or kind of applications.
Most applications are web applications these days. That's inevitable. And when we do surveys and things like that, we see, 80% of the people or something are doing web applications. And those tend to be in areas like e-commerce and travel apps and financial apps and just all the sort of typical business enterprise type applications. And there's a lot of different companies using it, you know, insurance, travel, all those kinds of domains. There's a lot of big companies that people have heard of that are using Clojure for those kinds of things.
Can you use it for mobile development as well?
You can. And so so probably the leading contender right now for that sort of thing is to use React Native and ClojureScript. That's probably probably the easiest path right now to cross-platform mobile development and things like that. Because Clojure runs on the JVM and the Android runs Java classes or compiled Java classes to the Android engine, it is possible to do that. There are various technical reasons why that's not the fastest thing to do. And so that hasn't been too well supported in the last few years. And so most people that are doing development are using React Native as far as I know.
Okay. Makes sense. Yeah, Clojure is personally my favorite language. And I get a lot of like comment. I think it's interesting, like from the Haskell and Scala communities, you would think that they'd be like, oh, another functional programming language. Welcome to the club. But then they're always like, where's the types? And I always really, I get a bit apologetic about it maybe, but I kind of never know what to say to someone who's like, I really want a strongly typed language. I can see where they come from. Like, why compile, like if the compiler helps me program a like something that's better. But I never really know what to have to say because I never miss types. Can you like maybe elaborate on the benefits of dynamically typed languages?
Yeah. And I've spent more of my career working with statically typed languages than working with dynamically typed languages. So I have a lot of experience in both. I think it's pretty easy to sort of talk about the benefits of statically typed languages in terms of enforcement and things like that. I think that not people don't talk very often about the costs of dynamic languages in terms of, I mean, static type languages in terms of the things that they put in your way in terms of flexibility of growth of a code base over time and things like that. And you'll find that like most large statically typed applications have portions of the application that are actually effectively dynamically typed. Mm-hmm. Like you might be shoving that stuff in a map or something like that to get around that. But you'll find that there are often parts of a statically typed language that end up needing to be a little bit more flexible and that you expect to change more frequently over time and things like that. So you can sort of turn those things around and say, instead, why don't we start from that perspective and have that flexibility all the time, but then allow us to add additional validation or checks or things like that at the places where it's important to sort of get those benefits of statically typed languages. And I think Clojure has found a path that makes it really easy to rapidly build up applications, build functionality, and do those kinds of things. And we're starting to add some additional features in the latest version of Clojure with Clojure Spec that give you additional things that you would want, and you know, maybe coming from a statically typed language or something like that.
Can you like explain a little bit about what Spec is?
Sure. So like I was saying, like in Clojure, you really have a small number of core data structures that compose together to let you build all of your data together. So you have lists, vectors, maps, and sets. And those are the primary data structures. And actually, the majority, in practice, the majority of your data ends up in maps and vectors usually. And so you're really using primarily two data structures to model all of your data. The big benefit for that is that you can do generic programming. You really can use, we have this large library of functions that allow us to generically operate over different collection types. And this is all just standard functional programming stuff, being able to map and filter and replace and all these sorts of things. And So Clojure has this really well-developed library that works on generic data structures. And the benefits you get from that are tremendous reuse. You're always using this small number of data structures everywhere. You use it to represent everything, your configuration data, your data coming from your database, your data coming from the user over the wire. All those things end up being just this small number of data structures. So the thing that I always felt like I was promised in object-oriented languages like Java was this, you know, oh, you're going to be able to make these objects and then reuse them. But in practice, what I always found was that you were making these very bespoke custom objects that I couldn't reuse at all. And so you rarely got any reuse out of them. So I feel like I get like a tremendous amount of reuse out of the small number of data structures that Clojure provides and that the library it provides to work on them. The flip side of that, though, is that what that means when you look at a function that operates on your customer data is just represented as a map. Mm-hmm. Whereas in like an object-oriented or statically typed language, you might actually have a customer object or a customer type of some kind. And so you've actually have lost some of the concrete details about what's happening. They're no longer as visible in your code. Instead of being annotations and on your functions and things like that, they're sort of implicit in the structure of the data.
Okay.
And so Clojure Spec gives us tools to actually continue programming in the same generic way that we have been, but add additionally the ability to annotate that data and say, oh, this map is actually not just a map, it's actually conforms to a customer specification and it has these attributes. Mm-hmm. And these attributes have their own, you know, nested format. And once we have that, we have the ability to talk precisely about data structures in concrete terms that are useful to the programmer as they're communicating things, and then also be able to do things like validate that data, check whether if it's invalid, tell us things about the way that it's invalid, and so you can get explanations of invalid data. And then it also has built into it the ability to generate example data that's conforms to the specification. And so you can actually do generative testing where you generate random customers and you can then inject them into a function and verify that it actually does things you say it does. And so that actually goes way beyond what most people get out of statically typed languages. Mm-hmm. So I think it's really an exciting addition to Clojure to have that new functionality in there.
How easy is it to get started with Spec?
I think it's very easy. I mean, there are definitely some things you need to learn in terms of the different spec forms and ways that you can specify specs for compose specs together, basically. Specs are inherently made of predicates. And so predicates are just functions that have the ability to take a value and tell you something logically true or false about it. So is this number odd? Is this string empty? Things like that. So those are example predicates. And then we have a bunch of a family of composites that can combine those things together in terms of logically anding and oring them, or talking about collections of predicates and things like that. So once you often already have the predicates, they already exist in your program because you need them for the actual program code. And then it's just a matter of learning this set of forms that you can use to combine them together. So,
In my experience, like it's very easy to like write a Clojure program. Mm-hmm. But how easy is it to maintain the code? It's like you just write it down and then it works. But then, I guess with the dynamicness of the language, maybe Spec helps a bit. But then you might forget what a function does if it's not well documented.
So I think Spec is really stepping in there to have the ability to put language around more precise specifications for what data is flowing in and out of your system. And so that's a big new tool that we have. And it also includes the ability to include instrumentation. And so you can instrument a function and then get immediate feedback if you invoke it with an invalid value.
What does instrumenting mean? Sorry.
So instrumenting means that we basically take a function that exists and you wrap a little function layer around it that checks the input values to verify that they conform to the spec for that function.
Okay. Okay.
And so you can, anytime you, so during development, you will turn on these things, and they have some costs because you're basically mm-hmm. wrapping every function in another function. So, but every time you invoke a function, you're getting these extra checks. And at development time, I found it to be really a transformative thing. It really gives you much better feedback, much faster than you got before. And then the other thing that I would say is that the way that most closure developers work is with a very close sort of integration with a REPL, which is a read eval print loop. And that's sort mm-hmm. of actually a lot of different languages have some sort of a interpreter that you can run and run commands or expressions in the language and see the results. For any Lisp, that's really not an interpreter. That's really actually the heart of what running a Lisp-like program is. It's really this notion of just reading a form, evaluating it, and then, you know, printing the result or, you know, reading the next form and doing more work. And so it's really what I call the sort of the beating heart of Lisp. So, mm-hmm. and that's just given to you directly and you can work with it. And so most people work in an editor, but then they're able to send a particular form, a parenthesized expression in their mm-hmm. editor over to the REPL and evaluate it. And you sort of build up this state and you're sort of working with the REPL back and forth in terms of you're building up a function and then you're evaluating that function. And then you're creating data and inserting that data and invoking the function with the data. And that gives you this sort of very rapid feedback cycle to sort of understand what your program is doing. And I think the question you asked is really like, how does that work over time? And some of it is just typical, just doing good diligence on, mm-hmm. you know, documenting what your code does and providing enough hooks so that when the next person comes along, it's easy for them to sort of pick up the strands and mm-hmm. build up a state that puts them back in that REPL workflow. So you do need to take some care there. And I think there's a lot of sort of best practices around the way that you manage your code in terms of typically named code is in functions and the functions are collected in namespaces. Namespaces are often sort of organized around data structures. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of times you'll see at the bottom of a namespace, a comment block that has example data structures in it and example code and things that you can go directly there and start evaluating some things and give yourself mm-hmm. some state to work with the functions in that namespace.
So what's the documentation like?
So it's terse. the actual Clojure API docs itself are intentionally terse, partly because that documentation gets compiled into the final classes mm-hmm. Typically, and that means that you can, at a REPL, ask for the documentation for a function and it can show you that. If it's available, it can also show you, you know, the actual source of the function itself. And I'd say that in Clojure, probably more so than in most other languages, I find myself looking at the source of the functions I'm invoking mm-hmm. Or the functions in the core library more frequently. And that's just, I think, just sort of the nature of mm-hmm. Clojure and Lisp and things like that, is that you tend to just do more of that sort of investigation at the REPL yeah. naturally.
I actually read Clojure source code.
Yeah.
I never read Java source code. So would you say, like, as a rule of thumb, is Clojure easier like to maintain than a language like, say, Java, or less easy to maintain?
Well, I think you have the same exact problems you have in any other language in terms of the problems that are problems in other languages are problems in Clojure too. It's this notion of you're building a large set of, you know, abstractions and in concrete implementation details and things like that. And you need to be able to walk up to the system and understand what it's doing. And so the bulk of my career has been working in Java. And when you walk up to a Java system, you're necessarily going to find a lot of classes. Those classes will have Java doc and you'll mm-hmm. Be able to start looking at those things. And it's the exact same thing
for
closure.
Hopefully have JavaDoc.
Yeah, well, hopefully you'll have JavaDoc for at least the things that you care about. And the same is true of closure. You want to look for doc strings and things like that. The big difference in from what I see is that with closure, you typically are looking at anywhere from 10 or 100 times more concise code. And so that typically means that you have to read a lot smaller, a smaller number of lines to actually get sort of the same conceptual unit that you do in Java. And that's something that's easy to sort of explain away as not important. In my experience, it is important. Like it being able to find that the implementation of something all exists in one file and that file is 50 lines long. Mm-hmm. That gives me a lot of a much narrower focus on what to look at and what I can see at a time on a screen. Mm-hmm. You can just fit an enormous amount of code on, you know, enormous amount of value onto one screen. And so I find that to be really valuable.
Yeah. So like, so you have a little program and you can see it and, but like for a bigger application, you probably need more than one file, right?
Yes.
Absolutely. So do you have any tips on like, are there architectural patterns or something that have kind of become standard or an opinion or something to help structure your application?
Mm-hmm. This is a really common question, especially for new closure developers. Generally, I find, I generally don't actually find it that hard to do that sort of stuff myself. And so that's a thing that I've thought about a lot, trying to sort of just mentally piece through like why, like when do I make the decision of how to split things apart? And it's really the same kinds of decisions I make in other languages is a lot of times in like Java, you have a class that's really, you're orienting a file is really about a class. And that class is about, you know, representing something. And similarly in closure, you're going to have a file, which is a namespace, and it's typically going to be things that are about sort of one data structure or one small collection of data structures that are important. So you might have a collection of functions that are about a function or something like, or about a customer or something like that. Or you might have a set of functions that provide some functionality, some particular handler in a web app or mm-hmm. something like that. And it's really one of those things that as you work on enough closure code, you sort of get to that point where you get that sort of uneasy feeling like there's getting to be too much stuff in this file. Like I need to impose some more structure on it. And I've done some analysis on different, on larger code bases to look at that. And generally it seems like that limit, at least for me personally, is somewhere in the 200 to 500 lines of code range. Mm-hmm. Like that's where I start feeling uneasy. And that's actually pretty small compared to other languages. But that's,
you mean like as the whole program or just one file?
In a file. So that's like once, file. Like I find that when stuff gets to be over about 500 lines of closure, then typically there's some logical structure. Mm-hmm. There's some logical divisions in there that will then lead me to break that out into multiple namespaces or things like that.
So do you usually like put everything in one namespace and then like later extracted into other namespaces?
Mostly. And so, I mean, I think there are definitely times when I start working on something where I know that there's like independent things that I want to make that I know are going to evolve at different rates or they're about mm-hmm. different things. And I'll just naturally start by putting those in different files. But if I'm not sure, if I'm like really just sort of starting and working through it, I'll just put everything in one file. And at some point, like there will logically, the structure will start to emerge and I'll find that in the file itself, I've segmented and written a comment line that says now, you know, this is now mm-hmm. stuff about this. And those eventually become really distinct units. And at some point I just take that chunk of code and move it into another namespace and expand out from there.
What's the largest code base you've worked on in closure?
Well, closure itself, closure core itself is one gigantic file.
So it's written in closure.
Well, it's a mixture of Java and closure. And so a lot of the data structures and some of the concurrency primitives and things like mm-hmm. that are in Java. And the compiler, of course, the compiler is one giant file. But the closure core library is the actual core library itself is actually split It's actually one namespace split across a number of files, but those, some of those are the main core one is pretty large, and it's unwieldy. I mean, it's actually mm-hmm. painfully large, but there are reasons why it is the way it is. And so
never thought about how big that file must be.
It's thousands of lines. So that's, yeah. it's a lot of stuff to look through. It's a, mm-hmm. it's definitely one of those things where you can load it in a typical closure editor to test how well it handles large files. Mm-hmm. So
those are like all of the normal functions that you would want to use, map, reduce.
Right. Most of the core library is in.
How many functions are there in the core library?
There are roughly about 700 or 800, something like that. Wow. So that most of those are two lines. I mean, most of them are tiny functions. And then there are other, it is actually split across multiple files. There are ways to split a namespace across multiple files. And so there are chunks of it for things like the parts that define protocols and data types, and mm-hmm. that's pushed off in another file. And some of the printing parts, pretty printing, mm-hmm. and some of those are pushed off in separate files as well.
So how popular is Clojure?
It's a little hard to get hard numbers on any of that thing, but I can pretty safely say that there are tens of thousands of Clojure developers out there in the world, and it's being used at hundreds or thousands of companies, many of which are, you know, sort of Fortune 500 type companies. And we at Cognitech work with people at some of these big companies, and some of them are not still a little circumspect about saying publicly that they use Clojure. So there are definitely more companies using it than are talking about it. But it's always interesting coming to a conference.
Is it something to be ashamed of?
I think, well, some people use it as sort of a strategic advantage. And so, okay. they don't want to talk about it too much. And some companies are just naturally more stealthy about what they're doing internally. So, and they don't want to be known for their tech as much. They want to be known for their product. So, they just don't talk about it quite as much. And sometimes we're able to convince them to go do a talk at a conference, and sometimes they're not. So, but it's being used in all sorts of big companies all over the place. And so
what's tooling like?
There's a lot of tooling. And so it used to be back when I started that was like one of the number one complaints is tooling, and people still complain about it because people always want better tools. Right. Mm-hmm. But there are fantastic tools available. There, as far as editors go, probably the two, leading ones that most people use are either Emacs, which is the sort of programmer's editor of old. And that's still probably the most common one that you'll see in the Clojure community. IntelliJ, there's an IntelliJ plugin called Cursive that's a commercial and plugin that's developed by Colin Fleming. And that's also really good. I actually use both Emacs and Cursive for different situations. And then there are, you know, Eclipse plugins if you want more of an IDE experience. There's Vim plugins if you're a Vim user. There's, you know, Sublime Text and TextMate and other sort of more Clojure focused things like Nightcode and Lighttable. So there are lots and lots of editors. And Atom actually has really good support these days for sort of more web-based editing workflow. When you're in Clojure, you can use JVM tools as well. So mm-hmm. people use tools like YourKit to do performance and memory debugging, or there are now good debuggers available in both Cursive and Emacs that you can use. And then there are some more interesting tools that people have been starting to build out lately that really leverage a lot of Clojure's sort of unique strengths, things like ProtoREPL and Saeed. So there's new things coming out all the time. It's hard to keep on top of all of it. But
is there like support in the editors for like spec? Because I would think that finally, you know, before it was all dynamic, mm-hmm. we didn't know what was coming in, but now maybe we could.
There's a new version of functions. Cider, which is the mm-hmm. Emacs tooling for Clojure that came out yesterday, which includes a vastly expanded support for spec and a spec mm-hmm. visualizer of some kind. I have not had a chance to actually even see it yet, but that just came out. And I know that Colin is also working on some spec-related V8 features for Cursive as well. And so that stuff is not actually out yet. And the spec is not actually part of a stable closure release yet. Mm-hmm. And so I think tool authors are waiting a little bit for a little bit more finality on some of that.
if someone's just getting started out with closure, what editor tooling do you recommend usually?
So I would say my first question is, do you already have a programming editor that you like? Mm-hmm. And if you do, then you should probably use that one mm-hmm. so that you're focusing on learning closure and not learning another tool to use closure with. So I would not say go download Emacs and learn Emacs to learn closure or something like that. I don't think that's a good idea. Mm-hmm. So, and you don't need Emacs to learn closure for sure. When I first started using closure, I used TextMate and I didn't use any tooling of any kind. I used just a raw text editor and a REPL for, mm-hmm. a few months, until I felt comfortable that I understood what was happening. And then I dove into Emacs and did more mm-hmm. with Emacs at that point.
You mentioned Cider, but what is Cider actually?
So Cider is a set of tooling that runs inside of Emacs, mm-hmm. And it provides sort of integration with a REPL and debugging tools and code completion and all those sorts of things. And so all the things that you want in a modern sort of development environment. And Cursive also provides most of those same things. So they provide them in a very different way. It's a very a GUI way versus Emacs. And so there's different people tend to gravitate towards one or the other. I tend to use Cursive most of the time. That fits mm-hmm. my workflow. It's not quite as sort of text, command friendly. You tend to do a little bit more, pointing and clicking with the mouse and things like that. That doesn't bother me. I find that allows me to sort of structure things a little bit better and really in closure, I find it's not really about the typing as much. So mm-hmm. it's really about the thinking. Hopefully closure and your tools get out of your way as much as possible and just let you focus mm-hmm. on solving your problems. So,
how long does it take for a new person, to get familiar with closure?
I think it really depends a lot on the background. For me, I did some Scheme in college, and when I picked up Closure, I was productive within a few days. Mm-hmm. But for whatever reason, Closure has a very natural match to my brain and the way that I think about things. Mm-hmm. And so I for me, it was just like, oh yeah, this makes total sense. And I totally understand how to do things. And so it was just a very natural match. But in general, I think I think you can learn the basics within a couple weeks. Mm-hmm. And Closure is nicely sort of made up of a bunch of independent things. And you can sort of choose which parts of it to use. And you can defer learning about a lot of different topics for a long time. And mm-hmm. Macros is something that Lisp is typically known for. Macros are the the ability of thinking about your source code itself as a data structure and then applying functions to take input data structures, which happen to be code, transform mm-hmm. them, produce output data structures, which also happen to be code. So macros are just functions that take code and return code that happen to run sort of a little earlier in the process. Macros are sort of often thought about as a tricky subject, and certainly there are a bunch of different tricky things that come up in macros, and they can get very, very complicated. If they're sort of macros that generate macros and all sorts of crazy stuff. but when I learned Closure, I actually did not write a macro probably for the first year that I wrote Closure. You don't need macros. You can do almost everything you want to do without macros or using existing things that happen to be written as macros. And so that's a good example of a topic that you can defer learning about for a really long time. Mm-hmm. You can also defer learning about, the software transactional memory parts of it or different concurrency aspects of it or spec. All these things are sort of more a la carte where you mm-hmm. just pick which ones you want to use. And so the core things you need to really understand are, how do I define vars, or which really hold sort of functions and things like that? How do I define a function? How do I invoke a function? Mm-hmm. How do I use the core closure data structures? Those sorts of things, like I've taught a bunch of classes in closure, and we cover all of those things in the first day. So it's pretty easy to teach the, you know, the basics of closure within a few days, and be able to, you know, write code that does things.
So what would be your advice if someone wants to get started?
If you can find somebody to learn from, I think that's it's great to have a resource for someone to ask somebody about. There are a lot of good online communities to look at. There's an excellent Closure Slack community, which is very helpful. There's a beginner's room on there, and I answer questions there all the time, and a lot of other people do too. And it's a very friendly, open place to ask. There's also a good IRC channel, and people are on there all the time, and mailing lists and Reddit and all those things. As far as books go, there are a lot of different closure books. Some of the more recent ones that are really good sort of intro texts are Closure for the Brave and True, which is actually available as a free online book and also as a printed version from No Starch. And that one's by Daniel Higginbotham. A lot of people like Karen Meyer's Living Closure, which is an O'Reilly book. I'm actually working on the third edition of Programming Closure, which was actually the very first closure book. And actually the one I learned closure from, that's written by Stu Holloway, was originally written by Stu Holloway. And then the second edition was done by Aaron Bedra, and I'm working on the third edition, and that's out in beta right now from Pragmatic.
Wrote a book.
And I also have a book that I co-authored with Ben Van Grift called Closure Applied. And that's really intended to be a second book. And so it doesn't cover syntax at all. It assumes that you've read one of these other books and that you've, you know, spent some time working with closure, and it answers a lot of questions about things like, how do I structure my namespaces, and how do I use state? How do I, if I have a concurrency problem, how do I approach that? What are the different tools available, and which one should I choose? And things like that. And so it's meant to sort of act as sort of the, a really good sort of journeyman book, you know, sort of, okay, I think I understand how the language works kind of, but how do I actually apply it to problems? And so that's, what it's trying to sort of fill in the gaps on.
Great. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to answer all my questions.
No problem. I was happy to talk to you.
Okay.
Always happy to talk about closure.
Me too.